This is the Zero Input Agriculture podcast. If you would like to support this show, sign up for a paid Substack account, buy a copy of the Taming the Apocalypse ebook, or if you want to delve into a hard biological sci-fi glimpse of the future, check out Our Vitreous Womb, published under my pen name Haldane B. Doyle. Book review: Seeing Like a State. Over the holiday season, I had a chance to read Seeing Like a State by James C. Scott. This book explores the tension between supposed rulers and the people they claim to lead. As such, I believe it can be a useful resource for contemplating how centralized power might behave during the decline of industrial civilization. The book jumps between a range of topics related to the central thesis. There is no clear structure, but it paints a picture through 100 brushstrokes. The section on architecturally designed cities made me smile. These monuments to the perfection of blueprints inevitably turn into failures for the people living inside them. I worked in Canberra, Australia's architecturally designed administrative capital, for a few years, and remember the surreal feeling, like I was living inside some weird magical bubble that kept the real world at bay. Such designed cities typically end up with an unplanned city on their periphery for the ordinary people who work to keep the monument from crumbling. For Canberra, it was the gritty town of Queanbeyan. A central theme of the book is the inability of distant elites and bureaucrats to fully understand the rich complexity of local conditions across the spaces they hope to manage. The only way they can approach the problem is to oversimplify the map, driven by the sheer impracticality of measuring everything in detail, and by an aesthetic obsession that despises the messy complexity of the real world. Medieval kings had the challenge of extracting tax, in the form of grain, resources, and army conscripts, from the predominantly peasant population. For most of history, the peasants had considerable power to resist the demands of their distant rulers, often helped by the local elites, who maintained a functional balance between the macro and micro levels of the nation. Modernity broke this dynamic by putting more power in the hands of central planners. The complex tapestry of shifting land access for peasants was replaced by a conglomerated exclusive ownership, often driven by the desire of central authorities to have a more legible and therefore more easily exploited resource base. Peasants did not think in terms of areas of land, but understood each location in terms of the number of days needed to work it and the likely return on their efforts. Central planners reduced this richly varied territory to an empty map to contain their plans. Many times, a complex, stable, and highly productive system was destroyed to make way for a simpler and less productive system that is nevertheless easier to exploit and extract. This is an extension of the original dynamic of agriculture, where an ecosystem with hundreds of species is replaced by a farm with dozens. The interplanting of multiple crop species was later replaced by monocultures in order to make harvest by machinery more convenient. The yields from complex systems are difficult to measure and quantify, making extraction, taxation, and improvement difficult. If you are producing 100 crops from a space, then determining if a particular fertilizer increases yield is a logistical nightmare. What if some crops increase and others decrease? The only tool available for a rationalist is to convert all of the crops into monetary value. A large chunk of the book focuses on the disastrous collectivization of Soviet agriculture, in part driven by the fanatical demands of central planners determined to industrialize the nation as swiftly as possible. Much of this unfolding story involved the shifting power dynamics between the peasant farmers. Then later, when central authorities destroyed the wealthy kulak farmers that sprang up in their place. When cornered, central powers choose lower yields in return for tighter control. The people only survived by finding ways to circumvent the official rules without drawing the ire of the officials. Those who openly rebelled were eradicated. Another interesting section focused on a similar program of forced resettlement of the rural population of post-colonial Tanzania into planned villages by their benevolent dictator. Millions of people were uprooted from their complex patchwork of traditional farms into scientific villages, often located in regions without water or fertile soil. The towns were designed as long rows of crude huts on either side of the main roads, mostly as a way to simplify monitoring the population and to prevent people from escaping. I was shocked to realize that so much traditional knowledge and locally adapted crop genetics was lost throughout the developing world during the 20th century following similar misadventures. A harsher version of this process drove the famous famine in Ethiopia in the 1980s. One section that I really enjoyed focused on the topic of metis, a Greek word meaning the knack or feel for a subject that can only be gained through practical experience. Abstract theoretical learning can be useful, but it is hopeless for the mastery of almost any skill you care to imagine other than pure mathematics. Even factories, the supposed temple of rational design, usually rely on skilled tradespeople who can compensate for variations in the quality of feedstocks and the changing idiosyncrasies of particular pieces of machinery. Western humans seem uniquely deprived of the metis necessary for a good life. Our education system is dominated by abstraction to the point that many young people struggle to cook, clean, care for their health, or interact with others. One question this book doesn't directly address jumped right out at me. Why did this modern, centralized, abstract, and simplified way of looking at the world emerge at this time in history? The obvious answer is that industrialization gave central authorities a vast range of new powers, namely rapid transportation and communication, and more centralized tools for violence against dissenters. This made the enforcement of uniform language, measures, and time zones on distant populations desirable and feasible. The book covers the standardization of society under Napoleon in some detail. Before the invention of railroads, grain could not be moved long distance over land, which created vast hinterlands of peasants away from the navigable rivers, which were almost impossible to tax. This in turn kept political structures relatively small and prevented authorities from exercising too much power in larger nations. To begin, these industrial powers allowed central authorities to impose their will, but did not give them the corresponding capacity for measuring local conditions across their varied territories. Determining the right level of taxation of peasants is vital. Too low and you miss out on resources to build central power. Too high and you risk a rebellion or the ruination of the countryside. As such, I tend to think of this period of early industrialization like a hand that grew monstrously large before it was connected to an eyeball to direct its movement. After World War II, nations redoubled their efforts to exhaustively measure the activity and resources of their territory. This process was wonderfully documented in the documentary All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace by Adam Curtis, which explored the USSR attempt at producing a perfect centrally planned economy through massive measurement programs linked to computer models. Unsurprisingly, this attempt failed. The hand was stronger than the eye was clear. With the explosion of the information age, it might be tempting to think that this problem has finally been solved. We are the most thoroughly monitored, measured, and surveilled population that has ever existed. Our behavior is constantly nudged and adjusted to make us easier to centrally manage, though corporations are calling the shots more than governments. Maybe the eye has outgrown the hand. Consider the explosion in the number of administrators versus teachers or nurses in the education and health systems. The bureaucracy has grown parasitic, often to the point that supposed leaders are unable to control or resist it. Both the hand and the eye face challenges in the future. The internet is the most expensive, fragile, and complicated machine humanity has ever built. It is constantly breaking, both in terms of hardware that needs constant replacement, and the software which is constantly under attack from malicious actors and in need of bug fixes. The internet relies on a constant supply of affordable microprocessors, all of which come from a couple of factories in Taiwan. The metis necessary to make such chips is not easily replicated in a hurry, though the USA is trying to do so, which is usually the worst way to master a complex craft. The ability for central power to extend its hand is also under threat, though maintaining road infrastructure, powered vehicles, and firearms is probably less technologically demanded than sustaining the internet. We may return to a world of distant authorities who occasionally show up to shoot first and make measurements later. Or we might end up under a new regime where our leaders are still capable of monitoring our every move, but paralyzed when it comes to enforcing their directives. A combination of these dynamics already exists in many parts of the world, where satellites monitor the movement of individual people, but the best authorities can do is an occasional drone strike. Such power has proven uniquely impotent in achieving meaningful or enduring strategic goals. A useful analogy might focus on the relationship between a doctor and their patients. Under one extreme, the doctor might have access to a medicine cabinet full of powerful drugs, capable of treating any condition, but they lack the ability to diagnose any of their patients. At best, they can guess, but the wrong drug will only do harm. At the other extreme, picture a doctor with the most advanced array of scans and tests imaginable, capable of diagnosing any condition with absolute certainty. However, this doctor hasn't a single treatment to offer, so the fancy diagnostic labels are more or less useless. A similar set of potential imbalances exists between rulers and the ruled. Looking forward, it is worth considering if this book has any insights into how ordinary people might interact with our supposed leaders through the decline of industrialization that lies ahead of us. The first lesson is that power often picks a solution to a crisis without any meaningful evidence it will solve the problem. Authority does this in order to be seen to be doing something, then sticks to its guns even as problems mount in order to save face within their institutional structure. I would not be surprised to see the more convenient concepts from permaculture or other experimental farming movements taken up with great enthusiasm by desperate leaders, only for them to create fresh disasters through ham-fisted implementation. In the event of such circumstances, history suggests that the best approach is to nod and agree with the friendly officials that drove out to deliver the good news, then quietly dig in your heels and make your own locally appropriate plans when their back is turned. Open opposition, no matter how well informed, no matter how much evidence it has behind it, will not help in the slightest. In fact, the more effectively you undermine the latest government initiative, the more you will be viewed as a threat. A good example of this was outlined in the documentary Wartime Farm. Under a shipping blockade, Britain engaged in a centralized plan to increase local food production. Government officials ordered a local farmer to plow a hill and plant grain. He stubbornly refused on the basis that the land was unsuitable, and the conflict escalated to a shootout with the authorities. After the farmer was dead, the hill was ploughed and planted, and it yielded nothing worth harvesting. The space probably lost what little topsoil remained. A cleverer farmer would have pretended to comply, but then stumble on a long series of mundane obstacles that prevented them from completing the work. Bureaucrats are more forgiving of incompetence than insolence. Government institutions train them in this habit every working day. Illegibility is precisely the weapon that we must be prepared to wield in the face of clueless and reckless centralized power during its decline and fragmentation. This is where I believe experimental crops have a huge advantage. Growing a crop that nobody can identify or make use of, or even enjoy eating if you served it up to them on a silver platter, is the perfect superpower for an age of chaos. Humans can be highly adaptable creatures, but we are also stubbornly set in our ways, including in times of disaster. In many ways, we all suffer the same flaws as the distant powers, disconnected from the land around us and its varied opportunities. We long for simple answers. How many square meters of potatoes to feed a family? How far apart to space trees? What calendar date to sow tomatoes? We impose childish plans, drawn up on pieces of paper, as if we were gods looking down from the clouds, with every tree and bush laid out like a piece of furniture in an empty room. These crude abstractions are all we have inherited to deal with the complexity of our world. Our ancestors learned to live in the world as it is by living within it, with all of their senses activated. Although we have forgotten 1,000 years of lessons, there is still time to reclaim the vital and indescribable knack for living in the world that is, rather than dreaming about the world we wish for.